Welcome to the Get Ready Podcast. Today we are on part 8 of our 10-part series, How to Get Prepared for a 90-Day SHTF Event. This episode is all about how to keep your family safe in a world without rule of law. If you've called 911 and waited more than 5 minutes for help to arrive, go ahead and share this episode with a friend. Here are your hosts, RB and JD.
Thank you, Jeffries. Welcome, everyone, to the Get Ready Podcast. This is RB, joined by my friend and co-host, JD.
Hello, everyone. In today's episode, we're going to show you how to fortify your retreat to repel the gangs flooding out of nearby cities. If you don't have a retreat, try to apply these principles to your living situation. And as always, do the best with what you've got.
Most preppers start preparing out of fear. They're afraid that economic turmoil, world war, or power outages will disrupt their lives. But if fear is the motivating force behind preparing, you won't be successful long term. Our bodies aren't designed to constantly be in a state of fear. Over time, we'll become desensitized and preparing will be put aside until the next crisis. However, you can break the cycle if you can replace fear with fortitude. Fortitude is the essence of a strong mind. It is the ability to confront adversity with courage. If you value independence, freedom, and self-reliance, you need high doses of fortitude because you are taking ownership of your own security. In this episode, we'll show you how to strengthen your retreat security, but the goal isn't to scare you into buying more things. The goal is to inform you of the threats you'll face and show you how to repel them. Strengthening your security measures should increase your confidence, allowing you to confront adversity with courage. Don't get caught up with the fear-mongering of news organizations or fellow preppers. Focus on building fortitude, which will grow as you get your security preparations in place.
Let's get into it. In order to have a good security plan, we need to know what the threats are and where they're coming from. So let's break those threats down into different environments. We got major cities like New York that have more than 1 million people. Smaller cities. I'm in Virginia, so let's look at Richmond, for example. Maybe there's 100,000 to 1 million people. And then we've got our suburbs, our towns, and then real far out country living. So JD, what do you think the major threats will be in the big cities like New York, Chicago?
Yeah, it's a no-brainer that you're going to see widespread looting pretty early on. As people start to panic and get desperate, you'll see mobs start to riot. Those who have barricaded themselves in their apartments will eventually be forced to leave in search of food, and those in search of food will be breaking into other apartments. The idea and the chances of you being able to secure what you have inside a major city is impossible.
Yeah. How about those smaller cities where downtown there's these big apartment buildings, but the majority of residents, they live in single-family homes on side streets?
Yeah, I think it's going to be tough there as well. You know, the people in the urban centers have got to go somewhere too. And those suburbs are the first place where they're going to end up. And so, you know, the big threats that you're going to be facing are things like break-ins and random violence. Secondly, mob violence that extends from the city. And then fires that spread from the mob violence. You know, you've got all these homes are so close together that one of those houses catches on fire and it spreads throughout the neighborhood. You know, and then finally, after the first few weeks of chaos, what you're going to see is that the gangs are going to start locking down territories and they'll offer protection from other gangs. However, the price for that protection is not one that you're going to want to pay.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's only so long a society will go where there's no rule of law, just chaos and violence. At some point, someone's going to have to take over. The military or the National Guard is going to be brought in pretty much as soon as riots and mobs start to come up. And I think there's going to be a lot of anger directed at the government for not fixing the issue. So that's where we'll see a lot of clashes. I think there'll be some individual hostilities, ethnic issues or ideological issues and violence and scores being taken out between gangs. But the big violence is probably going to be citizens versus government until after a while, people are just very desperate for food. And I think it's everyone for themselves. And that's where those gangs do pop up.
I can see most people trying to keep their head down and stay out of it. But if the food doesn't start arriving soon, they're going to be out there protesting and committing violent acts as well.
Yeah, I mean, no one's going to sit in their house and just starve to death. They're going to get out there, figure out what's going on and try to vent some of that anger. It sounds very much like the Summer of Love a few years back where people were protesting during the day and guarding their home at night. It was basically a day job. What about the suburbs? What does that look like, and how long does it take before those major threats start to get to you?
I think it's got a lot of similarities with what's going on in the city at this time. You're going to have your two categories of threat, external and internal. So the external are going to be any kind of spillover from those urban areas, people coming in and wanting to take other people's stuff. And then internal, you're going to have neighbors who are going to be fighting over resources too. You know, some have prepared, some have not. Your kids are hungry, and so maybe it's time to go shopping at the neighbors. That's what it boils down.
I think we're going to be surprised at how long it's actually going to take for people to get really angry at each other. I really believe that in the suburbs, we might see a week, 2 weeks before people start really getting upset and violent. Like, you might have folks who at first are very much like, hey, neighbor, we're running a bit low on bread. Do you happen to have an extra can of food or some extra butter? And then I think there will be that tipping point where the capitalistic ideology turns into communism and the neighbors are like, the Millers are hoarding their food. They've got basements worth of food. And all of a sudden, the community bands together because you haven't lost 20, 30 pounds yet. And now your food is rightfully their food. Do you agree with the timeline there? Or do you have some different thoughts?
So from having seen this unfold in South Africa to some degree, we're going to go through a lot in this session. If there's one thing that you take away is that there's a mental shift that takes place in people when the rule of law breaks down. And people will do whatever they can get away with. And that delta, that difference between normal, everyday, moral, ethical living, and then people who do whatever they can, it'll give you whiplash in that, one, just how quick it happens, and two, just how devastating and violent it can be. To your example of, you know, hey, you know, we've run out of butter. Do you have any butter or any food? It goes from that to someone putting a bullet in your head to take your butter, just like that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I necessarily would see the community like rising up, but for sure you'll get people that are hungry that will kill you for your shoes that you're wearing if that's what they want to do.
How long do you think that'll take, that tipping point? Because I really do think, and I think we're saying the same thing, the first maybe 2 weeks, it's just going to be block parties and barbecues and use up all the food and talk about how weird this is that nobody's going to work. And then you do get to that tipping point where all of a sudden now it's a shotgun pointing at your neighbor, give me your stuff. What is that timeline going to be before it flips over from normal to third world?
I think it'll happen quicker than you'll believe. You know, there's a theory in criminology called the broken window theory. If you have an empty building, that empty building's windows will stay unbroken as long as it takes before the first window is broken. And once that first window is broken, every single other window will get broken. People will walk by, see the broken windows, pick up a stone and throw it through the window. I think it's the exact same thing. It'll take as long as it takes for someone to do something incredibly violent and then there be no repercussion for that to infiltrate the minds of everyone in your area. When that happens, you better watch out.
Do you think it's just a factor of starvation or do you think it's the fear?
No, I think it's the human condition. I think it's the reason why religion was invented, because prior to there being a code, you could do whatever you wanted. There was no real repercussion. And I'm not just talking about Judeo-Christian. I mean, society in general put rules in place to stop this kind of thing. And when those rules go away, our natural state is doing horrible, horrible things to each other. We will get there very quickly.
Yeah. Let's move on to rural towns and even further out in the country. I think there are going to be three main threats, depending on how long this thing lasts. I think the first one happening in, let's say, the first month are going to be the elements of society who have stirred up trouble in the past. So you've got teens who don't have to go to school. They're bored. They're looking to have some fun, looking to take advantage or an opportunity. You see this in like Philadelphia, where instead of it being a real protest against a police shooting, it's all of these people robbing stores because they have the opportunity without consequences. I think the second element is the addicts who they've run out of drugs and now they're in withdrawals. I think there's a lot more people who are on antidepressants and anxiety medications, who are addicted to opiums and painkillers than most of us realize, especially out in rural areas. The poorer the environment, the more likely people are to be hooked on these sort of stuff. And then the last thing is prisoners. And I don't know much about the prison system.
You would be very popular.
But I imagine that without electricity, you're not going to be able to operate very much within a prison. In modern prisons, all of the cell doors and all of the gates and stuff, they're all operated electronically. So if you're not able to operate those prison cells, these prisoners are dying in the cells. No air conditioning, no food, no water. And I think there's going to be a couple of prison guards who are going to say, I can't watch, I can't listen to this anymore. These people just dying. I'm going to let at least the nonviolent ones out. And then what happens from there, who knows? But that I think is the first threat, probably in the first month or so. And then month two, you start running into what I call the good old boys. He's out hunting, he's out trapping, he's out picking up all the crops and stuff. And they're moving further and further away looking for game, and they come across your place. And now they're thinking about maybe stealing your cow, you know, shooting your pig, whatever, and just taking a chainsaw and cutting off a limb and taking it back. And then the third one is organized gangs. And I think this is several months out, to where in the cities and especially the small towns, big gangs are going to take control, gather all the resources, and then they're going to send out scouting parties further and further out into the countryside to collect more resources. And that's where I think we're going to run into a bit of a problem for the retreats, because now you've got organized, fairly well-equipped, fairly well-trained, and just brutal people who will give you a real fight. What do you think?
Yeah, agreed. And if you think of just in terms of those organized gangs that, you know, what we've led through our southern border in the last two, three years, and the kind of firepower that they have, it's definitely something to take very seriously for when rule of law breaks down. You might be contending with some extremely well-organized, well-experienced groups that are out there. All right. So in our next segment, we'll get into how to secure your retreat from all of these threats. But first, let's work through a quick Southern Prepper Ones, Are You Ready for Roll card game scenario.
On December 16th, 2030, in New York City, New York, a solar flare causes a major power outage, disabling anything that relies on electricity. In your opinion, what would the next 7 days look like?
I think we've touched a little bit on this earlier on at the top of the episode, but what's the first 7 days going to look like? It's interesting that in New York City specifically, we actually had this happen about 20 years ago. There was a blackout from Ohio all the way up to, I know it was north of Connecticut, and of course, New York City. And you can look back at old TV footage of the coverage, and it's really fascinating because you think, all right, the cities will just start tearing themselves apart. That's not really what happened. The power shut off at around 4 p.m., came back on in the morning. All in all, it was a pretty calm event. Like, people were in the streets trying to walk around. There was very little transportation. But for the most part, you had residents directing traffic, helping people out, trying to assist their fellow man. It was a very good example of people coming together in a traumatic event, almost like a natural disaster. It was one of the best displays of the New York City spirit that we've seen, potentially excluding 9/11. But it only lasted, what, maybe 15, 20 hours. Wasn't even a full day, I don't think. But the whole point is there wasn't big looting. Wasn't big violence. It went through the night and we didn't have any major things catch on fire. There was confusion and anxiety, but most people, they just tried to get out of danger situations, the elevators, the subways, they got out of there and they could head home if they could, or they just spent the night and waited it out.
Yeah, look, I think that America was a very different time then. Not that I was here, but from what I understand, everyone came together, especially in New York City after 9/11.
Yeah.
It just was a very different time. It wasn't like now. I think what we saw, you know, in 2020 with the riot, when we saw how the police actually stepped back and individuals who defended themselves were absolutely slammed by the judicial system. And these mobs were just allowed to run buck wild. I think that as soon as there's an opportunity for something like this to happen, it'll happen. It's not going to look like it did back in 2020.
You don't think we'll get a couple days of relative calm? You think we'll see the violence and the looting and the mobs?
There might be. I don't think it would be immediate, but as soon as people realize that we're in this for longer than, say, a day, I think it would get real, really quickly.
Yeah. I seem to think day one and day two are probably going to be pretty low key because we've never had an extended power outage before. And I think it's going to take time for people to realize, to your point, that, oh, power's not going to come back on. I don't have accountability. Cops can't get to me. And their human nature has the ability to come out without consequences. In the situation where it is December, it's snowy, it's cold outside, I think a lot of people are going to be keeping their heads down, trying to just wait it out, not starve to death, not freeze to death, and just hope the power comes back on. How long that takes, I don't exactly know. But I imagine after day two, day three, things start getting spicy. What do you think is going to happen in like day two, day three?
I think time of year is critical, right? I agree with you. It happens in December, in winter, or January, February. I mean, you got to be pretty motivated to go out. But at the same time, you're going to get motivated pretty quick because you're going to get hungry. By day three in the city, I don't know how much food people have the option of even storing, right? How many days food do they have, especially if you have a family of kids, especially if your kids are getting meals in the school system and the schools aren't working. By day three, it's getting hairy.
You've got two people in New York City. You've got the residents who actually live in apartments and houses, and then you've got commuters. So the people who have houses, they're going to have, let's call it, a couple days to a week's worth of food. And then you've got all the commuters who don't have any food. But there's a ton of food in restaurants and different stores. What do you think the restaurants and the stores and the pizza shops and all those places are going to do? Do you think they're going to just lock it down, keep everyone out, keep it closed? Or do you think they're going to open it up?
I mean, I think it depends. You might see some of that. You might see people trying to sell their stuff, maybe.
All right. So what about day four, day five, day six, day seven? When did things start getting truly frightening?
Well, I think after a week, it's going to be intense. I mean, you know, Hurricane Sandy, we lost power for 2 weeks. And it wasn't crazy. But again, like, America just wasn't what it is now. And there was a massive police presence. Maybe that kept people in line. But it was intense. Like, no power for 2 weeks. I don't know. But I have to imagine, like, if you're in the city and you're out of power for a week and you got no food and, you know, rule of law is starting to break down, I think a week is when it's starting to burn.
I think after day four is where things turn. And my thinking there is day one, you probably ate something. The next 2 or 3 days, you're going without food and you start to get very angry, very scared. And where you'd go to shops and say, hey, are you open? Can I trade my Rolex for a sandwich? At day four, now I'm going to break into this restaurant because I think there's food there. And to your broken window theory, as soon as one person does it, everyone's going to pile in. And I think people are going to start banging on doors saying, hey, can you help us? We need some food. We need whatever. Day four, day five, I think anger, lack of food, lack of law enforcement, things are going to get very dicey and people are going to start getting very violent. Okay, let's jump into the main topic here. So as an overview, our approach to security is to set up 5 concentric rings around your retreat. We're going to be looking at this in more of a country context, because if you have a suburban retreat, your likelihood of surviving is going to be pretty low anyway. So you have to get out to the country a little bit to have a good shot. So those 5 concentric rings are to deter, that's the outer ring, and then coming in, detect, delay, deny, and defend. It's like a sermon where everything starts with D so that you can remember it better. Imagine you're looking at a Google Map version of your retreat, and your main building is in the middle, in the center, and overlaid on it is a bullseye target with each red ring from that target representing a layer of security that we just mentioned. So we're going to start in the very outer perimeter, the very widest circle around your retreat, which is essentially going to be your property line. And we're going to start with deterrence. So as you can imagine, we're trying to persuade people who are considering entering to your property to move along without directly engaging with you. So ideally, we would remain completely hidden. If you've got a long driveway, let those trees and bushes cover up the entrance to make it more of a hidden driveway. Plant some thorny trees like Osage Orange up and down your road frontage. Once SHTF hits, pull up your mailbox, cover up the gravel with dirt and leaves. If you've got any big trees near the entrance, or if you've got any roads leading up to your house, you might think about getting your chainsaw out or maybe an axe and dropping some of those trees across the road to prevent people from driving through.
Yeah, and this is a two-edged sword because you're going to deter people from driving in, but you're also going to make it difficult to drive out as well. So, you know, if you took too long to bug out and your neighbor drops a bunch of trees across the way out of your neighborhood, now you've got to deal with that.
Yeah, that's a great point. For those who are thinking of bugging out, if you don't leave early enough, you're going to have a lot of these back roads that have been shut down by people who are trying to prevent people from driving through. You get your four-wheel drive, make sure you have a winch or something, a chainsaw with you on your bug out trip. That's probably a great tip. Have a chainsaw with you or a folding saw. Have you ever seen that TV show Jericho, JD?
I loved it. I loved the first series.
Yeah.
It got weird after that, but the first series was, I thought, really, really good.
Do you know why it went so weird? Just side note, they went on a writer's strike and all the writers quit. They didn't have any talented writers left for the second season, and it went totally off the hook.
And it was before ChatGPT.
Yeah, that would have solved it. Anyway, yeah. TV show Jericho, it's about a nuclear attack on a small rural town in America, how that town dealt with it. If you haven't seen it, I definitely recommend it. I agree with JD. The first season's pretty good. After that, it loses its way. But one of those episodes dealt with whether a small town should blow up the only bridge in and out to prevent a group of mercenaries from invading. And I'm not going to spoil it as to what happened, but the town had some of the people who wanted to keep the bridge because it was their only lifeline to the outside world, and it's the only way help could come in from the outside. And then others wanted to blow it up. It's a classic isolationist versus more of a community type approach. And I think you're going to see this within your retreat. Some people are going to want to interact with the outside world. Some people are going to want to keep your head down. So make sure you discuss this type of scenario with your group to see whether they're on the same page. But in terms of deterring, whether you decide to blow up the bridge or not, that is one option. You want to put the trees in front of the roads, reduce the ability to cross bridges. You should also have some sort of sign outside your retreat. Even something as simple as looters should be shot. Maybe sprayed paint on like wood near the entrance is a good start. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that anything you can put out there that will make people think twice, the casual sort of looter or opportunist think twice, you should do. But I will guarantee that there is going to be a collection of people in your group who will object to following through on that threat.
Yeah.
And you might handle that by just saying, it's just words.
Yeah. That's why you can't have democracy in a group like this, because people will vote for what they think is right, as opposed to what is necessary in a wartime.
Yeah. Yep. And things like this, you know, it's shifting the mindset. You know, we can talk quickly. Firing warning shots is a deterrent. So on the one hand, you've got the sign that says looters will be shot. Would it be stronger if, as they started climbing over the gate, ignoring the sign, you fired a warning shot? And so they hear the bang, or they hear the ping of the bullet on the sign, and so now they're going to turn around. Yeah, you know, on the one hand, but I think you give away a lot when you do that as well. Yeah, you give away your position. You could attract other people. Now they know that you're armed. Maybe it makes you even more attractive. You know, so you went from them maybe not knowing much to now they know a fair amount, and they might just be scouts for a bigger party. So stuff to think through, but you get the point. There does need to be some level of deterrence. Figuring out what your procedures are going to be is going to be up to your group.
I think this is a great argument for having a suppressed weapon, at least one suppressed weapon, to be able to send that bullet flying and hit something metal, the ping, so they look at that sign. They're like, oh, they're serious about it, as opposed to just letting them keep coming. If you don't have that and they ignore the sign, what are your other options?
You're going to be making some decisions.
Shoot them.
But that's the whole point, you know, is you got to have your operational procedures outlined. Everybody knows exactly what the policy is.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have to make sure that your rings are not getting breached.
Instead of sending people away, what are your thoughts on interviewing them? See if they have any useful skills, see if they bring any information to the retreat.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something to factor in. I don't know if I would do it as one of my rings. I'd probably want to set that up further away from my installation.
Oh, outside the deterrence. Maybe some checkpoints further up the road?
Right. Because you want to give away as little about you as possible. And then if there's anyone interesting that you feel could be a fit and you might want to talk to further, you can always play it out on your terms. But I think interviewing people at your gate is a recipe for getting ambushed.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't feel super comfortable sending people from my group outside of our perimeter to guard a checkpoint, but I'd be very interested in trying to make a deal with other people who are already outside our perimeter and saying, hey, we'll give you a loaf of bread and a radio, and you're going to guard that checkpoint, and you're going to talk to us and tell us who you find and what information you have. If you have the ability to produce something, maybe you hire people to be your sort of first line of defense. What do you think?
Yeah, that could work for sure.
I also think it depends on what your scenario is. Like, take a small town, for example. They've got tons of people. They got too many people. They're not going to want to take anyone else in. They already have their town doctor. Their big challenge is we don't have enough food for everyone. So I expect the sheriff of that town to set up blockades at major highway entrances and to try to turn people away unless they are residents of the town, or maybe they can prove that they have family there. I don't see them really inquiring much for news. I think it'll just be a checkpoint to keep people out.
Right.
And then suburbs, I guess they're going to do something similar to that, where they're not going to be keen on taking outsiders in.
Yeah.
I don't think they're looking at it from a long-term perspective. Like, we need a doctor. They're like, no, you're not from around here. We don't trust you. We're not letting you in.
Right.
I could see like a version of the checkpoint, like you mentioned, within each suburb, within each neighborhood.
Yeah, and also it depends on how long this has gone on for, you know.
How long you think it'll take before they get a checkpoint set up for the suburbs?
I think in the first 3 weeks, maybe no one's taking anyone except if you got your rural retreat and you've got your group set up and there's some, you know, displaced people that are walking and you're able to say, oh, what are you? I'm a metal worker from a factory. Great. Well, you can join. I think that's different. I think you're right. Like town, suburbs, any other kinds of areas, it's probably going to take longer for them to feel the pinch of not having enough people.
I wonder how long people are going to walk before they decide, I'm willing to just join a community I've never met before. Like, most people are trying to get somewhere.
Yeah, I think that happens pretty quick. I think if you're by yourself, it's just you and your family, you're under an extreme amount of threat. What they wanted to group up is going to be front of mind very early on.
Yeah, I'd imagine if you're traveling down the road, you're probably traveling in a group.
Potentially, but you're going to want to be, you know, in this kind of situation, three guys with guns can control like a significant, they can control an area, three or four guys. You know, you look at the attack in Israel just took place this last weekend, and you look at the carnage that was produced by like 10 guys with guns. The pressure to group up is going to hit you real quick.
Yeah. So I imagine those groups of people walking down the road, hit a checkpoint, answer some questions, maybe one family or a couple people or one person gets allowed into a community.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess those checkpoints will have to have some sort of precaution against disease.
Yep.
That's going to be a big deal.
Yep.
Once you're out into the country, those homesteads are going to realize they need to grow the numbers.
Yes.
If they have the ability to produce, like farms, for example, they're more likely to take in families early on, especially older farmers.
Right. Security.
They got a ton of beef, a ton of corn. You know, Martha's been canning for her whole life.
They got a real shot at making it. Yeah. They got a real shot at making it. But their like weak point is that there's probably a lot of land that they need to secure.
Yeah.
And things that need to get done.
Exactly.
Let's recap. One, hide your retreat from the road. A long S-curved driveway with a hidden entrance is best. 2. Use fencing, thorny bushes, and gates to funnel foot traffic to checkpoints. 3. Use vehicles and trees to block vehicle access. 4. Man a 24/7 guard at all main points of entry. 5. Use signs to warn people to keep out. 6. A warning shot from a suppressed weapon that hits the back of a looters will be shot sign can reinforce your message. 7. Post plenty of no trespassing signs before SHTF. 8. Be a producer, especially of bread and clean water. 9. Arrange with trusted neighbors outside your perimeter to man a security checkpoint in exchange for bread and water. 10. Use those security checkpoints to gather news and assess refugees for useful skills. 11. Take proper steps to avoid contracting diseases at security checkpoints. 12. Model your gate and signage after service road gates and signs in your area. 13. Geography plays a big role in retreat defense. Choose a retreat property with natural barriers like a river, steep cliffs, or thick brush. Now let's move on to the second ring of security, detection.
All right, while deterrence attempts to keep people outside your area, your detection system should alert you when they have entered into your perimeter. A good example of a detection system is a patrol. In a city, that may look like the military or some sort of state guard rolling around the streets in a town that might be a mix of sheriff's deputies and local citizens in the back of pickup trucks. If it's an EMP, the sheriff's probably going to have a number of older cars that he's taken and trucks that may still function. What does patrol look like in the suburbs?
You're going to have your area, whether it's a block or a neighborhood development. You're going to have access point. And then you're going to patrol either inside or outside. I'm sure the patrol are just residents that once you've figured out who's doing what, if you're bandying together, which you're probably going to have to be, you know, your security detail will patrol inside. And patrolling outside is probably even more important, making sure that you've got eyes on what's happening beyond and you have the ability to notice any threats that might be developing or on their way to you that you can relay back to your group.
Yeah, and the same is going to be true in the country with prepping teams. I think one difference is a prepping team, if done properly, should be practicing patrols now. Whereas in the suburbs, I think it's highly unlikely that a prepping team in the suburbs is going to be practicing patrols because it's going to look so odd to everyone else in the neighborhood. So that's probably not going to happen just as a practice thing. But in the country, yeah, who cares? You walk around the woods in your full kit, nobody bats an eye. Mm-hmm. But I would really think about starting out your patrols with a drone. Like I know DJI makes some very good drones at the consumer level. I personally like the Mavic and the Air are really good. I look at those lines. The Air is going to be a little bit more affordable, around $1,100. And the Mavic's going to be twice as expensive because it's a much better camera for photography. But if you've got a budget around $5,000, I would get the Mavic Thermal, which gives you eyes of the sky at night. Because that's one of the big downsides of using a drone is at nighttime, once it goes dark, you can't see anything.
Yeah, very important. Absolute game changer if you're able to afford that. And if you don't have the money for fancy tech, you might need to do patrols the old-fashioned way on foot. When you're doing that, you're going to be looking for evidence that people have entered your perimeter, cut fences, food wrappers, footprints, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And there's a ton of force multipliers if you don't have the manpower to be doing patrols.
A force multiplier is a capability that significantly increases the combat potential of that security team. For example, night vision allows you to see in the dark, increasing the effectiveness of your group who previously could only operate during the day.
Or even if you do have a little bit of manpower, this allows you to really maximize that. Tripwires and motion detectors are a really good start. You can think of tripwires as an alarm. The problem with them is the person who trips the wire is going to know that they've tripped the wire. A lot of those are like shotgun shells. I've seen some with flares. But once the intruder knows they've been spotted, they're going to run. So if your quick reaction force gets over to them, no one's going to be there. So that doesn't really help you all that much.
Yeah, and they can also inadvertently be tripped by animals. If the sound is too loud, it's going to give away your position to outsiders. There is downside to using these.
Yeah, and there's always ways around it. For example, you could set up infrared motion detectors. I know there's a company called Dakota Alert. They make a really good system where they have motion detectors that will alert like a single base unit in a house from 16 different detectors, right? So there's two ways of doing it. One, you could have your comm center in your house and it will ring a chime or a doorbell, or you set whatever sound you want for sector 1, sector 2, sector 16. And the second way of doing it is like a little pager-like device that everyone can have on their person. And once one of those motion detectors is set off, you get a little vibration or a sound. And all of a sudden, everyone knows in sector 3, something just walked in front of the motion detector.
Yeah, and game cameras are great as well. If cell phones are still working, you can get photo and video sent to your phone within a few seconds of motion being picked up. If the phones aren't working, your patrols will need to swap out memory card and check the footage every few days. But it will be after the fact.
Yeah.
One of the big challenges for security is at night when it's dark or foggy out. What are some of the things that can help here?
You know I love night vision and thermal. We've played around with a bunch of different devices over the years. I think they're game changers. I think we should take a second and unpack night vision and thermal for those who haven't used it before. Thermal devices, they use heat signatures to see at night, whereas night vision uses very sensitive light amplifiers to brighten up a dark image. So in some situations, like if it's very foggy out or if it's rainy, if an intruder is wearing camouflage, thermal is going to easily pick up their signature because the heat from their body is going to tell you, hey, there's something there. Whereas night vision is not going to see them at all because they're just going to see the camouflage and it's going to blend in. Whereas on the other hand, Night vision is very good at showing movement and allowing you good depth perception when you're moving. So if you're in a combat situation, you need to be quick reaction, you need to move and engage and shoot at night. Night vision is what you want. Whereas thermal, on the other hand, it's like a mini display screen that you're looking through. So it takes a little bit to refresh. It's not quite real time. You don't have depth perception. You don't have the field of view. It's something really great for a fixed defensive position, but really bad for an active combat position.
So let's summarize real quick for everyone. Number one, everyone on security should have a thermal monocular. I got a little Leopold thermal monocular. I think I bought it for like $600 and I love it. It's fantastic. Really, really useful. If you're out on the front line, you should have a PVS-14 night vision unit. They attach to your helmet and they run between $2,000 to $3,000. And if you're in an overwatch position or you need your rifle at night, you're going to want a thermal scope. ATN makes a great thermal scope that'll run you between $2,000 to $4,000.
I have to just emphasize how important night vision and thermal is. I distinctly remember I was doing an airsoft military simulation event one weekend, and I arrived there, it was my very first one, and they asked me if I had night vision or thermal. And I said, yeah, I have night vision. And they're like, great, we have more night vision than the opponent, so we're most likely going to win. That was how it was decided, even before the skirmish began. Whoever has more night vision wins the day.
I think you mean wins the night.
And then throughout the night, it was essentially like an army base where they had bunkers, and there's a little town in there. If you were on defense and you had night vision, you could be outside patrolling. If you didn't have night vision, you couldn't go outside the sleeping quarters. That was how important it was. You're basically useless. You're just going to die. You're your target and nothing else, unless you have night vision. So it's incredibly important, one of the most valuable things to do. A lot of people want to take the cheap way out. There's units on Amazon that cost $100 and they're terrible. Don't do it. It's not the same technology. The $100 units on Amazon are basically infrared cameras for security in your house. The range is terrible. You need a ton of infrared light to see anything. There's usually a little red dot or a red ring when the infrared light is showing because of the wavelength. And you can't hold it right up to your eye like you can night vision, because the little screen on these units are so bright that it's going to illuminate your whole face. And if you hold it too close so it doesn't illuminate your whole face, it becomes very blurry. So it's a no-win here, a terrible resolution. Don't do it. You're going to be very unhappy if you spend a couple $100 for a very cheap version of night vision. No one who takes fighting seriously at night is going to recommend these type of solutions to you.
So if people don't have the budget for high-end devices, and you're saying don't buy the cheap stuff, what's the best budget-friendly option?
I think you mentioned it. Those $600 to $800 low resolution thermal units are the very first thing you want to do. I'd really recommend everyone get that thermal monocular as their first step. And then the second step, you get your PVS-14. And then third step, you get a thermal rifle scope. But if you don't have any money at all, just not in the budget at all, you've got to go to no-tech solutions. Take dogs, for example. Dogs are a fantastic solution for detecting intruders. The bigger, the better. I know a lot of people love their yappy dogs, and they think they scare away thieves, and maybe they do in cities. But at night, you're going to want to have the biggest, burliest dog with the deepest bark you can possibly get. Like when you're doing that night patrol, and you hear that branch break 50 feet away from you, you want that fur rocket to be shooting after that intruder, holding him down while you get control of the situation.
Yeah, I love that fur rocket. I do want a fur rocket. what breeds work best here?
Yeah, I think everyone knows the obvious ones, like German Shepherds are really good, Rottweilers, Dobermans, Rhodesian Ridgebacks. The highly intelligent, medium to large-sized dogs are really good. And then if you're out in the country, you should consider getting a livestock guardian. Great Pyrenees, Anatolian Shepherds, all of the mixes and variations of those. The nice part about that is they can typically free range with your livestock and keep poachers at bay. Because I do think a very real threat is to have a good old boy with a crossbow or a compound bow, shoot one of your lambs in a field very quietly, hop over your fence, do a field butcher, or throw it on their backpack, take off. And it's very difficult to stop that. And you may not know until a day or two later.
Right. So some of the other things that you want to think about for detection is make sure you have clear lines of sight around your retreat. If you've got the woods coming up close to your house, clear that land to give you at least a few hundred feet of space with no trees. At the very least, clear the limbs 6 feet off the ground so people can't sneak right up to your house. I cannot stress this enough. If you have trees that are close to your house, it provides insane, not just concealment, but cover for anybody wanting to sit there and just snipe you out. Get rid of them. I don't care if you have to burn them down. Get rid. Push that tree line back as far as you can, because you do not want people sitting amongst you that you cannot tell that they're there.
I think this is huge. And when you say push the tree line back as far as you can, absolutely. But what do you think the minimum is for people to clear around their house to be relatively safe?
Well, look, a person can throw a baseball or say 100 feet. I think the farthest anyone has ever thrown is like 450. So swap the baseball out for a Molotov cocktail. Okay, so you definitely want to start by clearing at least 100 feet. At least. But it's got to be more than that. I would clear at the very least 500 yards. That's the effective range of an AR-15. And you should have a level of confidence. And then even once you've cleared out those trees, you need to have, as part of your procedure, patrols that roam through those trees and listening posts that are in that bush, so that you can make sure there's no one sneaking up on you.
I don't think people appreciate the tactical uses of fire. There's all sorts of footage coming out from the Hamas attack in Israel right now where Hamas is setting fire to people's houses and then shooting them as they roll out. And that's been very popular since basically fire was discovered. And a variation for this as a retreat attack would be to set an outbuilding on fire. And then as people start flooding out of the house, then you can make an attack there. And I could see this being very effective because of all the confusion that occurs in the middle of the night, for one. And two, you've got fire. So people who are running towards the fire and fighting this big blaze, their eyes are all dilated because of the brightness of the flames, and they can't see within the woods. They can't see the darkness around it. It is incredibly frightening. It's incredibly distracting because you probably have a bunch of supplies and gasoline in the whatever shed or barn that's on fire, your animals. It would be incredibly effective.
Yeah, it's very difficult to ignore your house being on fire. Oil lamps, wood stoves, you know, you might not even suspect that it's an attack at first. Devastating first strike and would cause a ton of confusion.
Yeah. Even if you cleared a few hundred yards around your house to give you clear line of sight, you're still not giving yourself much time to react. It only takes a few seconds for someone to bound a couple hundred yards. So you really need to set up LPOPs, like you mentioned earlier, far away from your retreat, because you need to be able to observe that enemy movement very early and then report back to your team to give them the time to get the security force in place.
LPOP stands for Listening Post, Observation Post. It is a hidden defensive position that allows someone from your team to observe an avenue of approach. A good LPOP should be placed where there is maximum observation, the occupants have cover and concealment, and they are within shooting range of your defensive team. A minimum of two individuals should operate at a time, one observing and one recording. After 20 to 30 minutes, they should switch duties because the visual efficiency of an observer fades quickly.
In the country, an LPOP could be as easy as a hunting blind or a tree stand or a debris shelter or even a straight up bunker. But what do you think an LPOP would look like in the suburbs?
Well, I think you've got a few things. Garbage mounting up outside of houses because there's no garbage disposal. You could use that as cover. It might be pretty nasty. But if you're in a town, I'm sure they're going to be buildings, abandoned houses, structures that have been looted. Take position in an area that overlooks somewhere that's interesting, like a road or a checkpoint or access point, and make sure that your scouts have binoculars, radios, thermal monoculars. You have to set up that situational awareness to be able to feedback any kind of threat to your treat or to your group.
I'd really consider making thermal monoculars a group minimum requirement. I know they're pricey, but it's just such a huge game changer. What do you think about the concept of a guard tower versus LPOPs? Pros, cons?
The guard tower is a defensive position. It's meant to be the tallest structure in the area. You see a lot of these in ancient castles or even modern prisons. But the reason why you see them there, especially on the ancient castle side, is because the technology that they had at the time really favored the person in the tower. And in prisons, in theory, the prisoners don't have guns. The guards in the tower do. And so you have an advantage. The problem in an SHTF situation is your guard tower is like a big fat arrow to everybody in the surrounding area to say, oh, look, there's something here worth protecting. Also, you may not have an advantage. It may not actually give you, apart from a line of sight, that might be your only advantage. It might actually turn you into a target. My preference is not to invest in building those towers. I think LPOPs, like deer blinds, you know, they're meant to be camouflaged, they're meant to be hidden. And I think most retreats should focus on that versus the construction of towers that are just going to kill your OPSEC.
Yeah, I agree. If you're thinking about an attack coming at your retreat, I think you'd agree it's probably going to happen at night or maybe the very early morning hours. And if you're elevated at a high position shooting down at night, the chances of you hitting something is next to nil. It's much better to be on the ground where you could strafe and fire a few shots, and that's going to go parallel with the ground for a huge distance. If you do have some sort of elevated position, you need to have lasers, infrared lasers, and night vision to be able to even get a chance at using it effectively. But I think the bigger problem is, to your point, is you're basically the first one to get shot out. So the only chance you have at not dying in a guard tower is to have some sort of ballistic protection, which makes it very heavy. And if you have very heavy elevated position, the tower needs to be made out of very strong materials. And if you have very strong materials, very high up, anyone who comes across that is going to say, all right, this is some sort of maximum security prison or compound, and there's something big inside.
And it's a significant investment at that point, and your money can be much better spent somewhere else.
Yeah, and how do you get up and down out of that thing? You know, you're going to be very vulnerable in whatever stairs you've got, unless you've got a zip line.
Yeah.
Let's recap this section on detection. 1. Frequent patrols are necessary to make sure your perimeter hasn't been breached. 2. Night vision and thermal are game changers and should be one of the highest priority security items for your group. 3. Night vision excels in combat scenarios where you are moving and shooting. Thermal excels at fixed positions. 4. Don't go cheap with thermal. Start with an entry-level thermal monocular, then get a PVS-14, then a thermal rifle scope. 5. Dogs are one of your best detection systems. Either get a large guard breed or a livestock guardian dog if you have livestock. 6. Clear 100 feet from your house to prevent fire attacks and 500 yards to protect against sniper attacks. 7. Set up listening posts and observation posts. 8. Don't bother constructing heavy-duty guard towers. They'll just give your OPSEC away. I'd like to leave you with a quote from Sun Tzu's The Art of War. To fight and conquer in all our battles is not supreme excellence. Supreme excellence consists in breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting. In other words, winning in a world without rule of law would be never having to shoot a single bullet, but to build so many layers of deterrence that the enemy simply gives up trying to attack you. If you don't want to miss next week's conclusion to the guys' discussion on retreat security, subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform or join our fantastic Telegram channel. Opening up your phone's browser and go to t.me/getreadypodcast. You'll love the behind-the-scenes photos and videos the guys share daily. Finally, remember to focus on fortitude. For the Get Ready Podcast, this is Jeffries. Good night.